The search for truth never ends. Introducing June's Journey, a hidden object mobile game with a captivating story. Connect with friends, explore the roaring 20s, and enjoy thrilling activities and challenges while supporting environmental causes. After 7 years, the adventure continues with our immersive travels feature. Explore distant cultures and engage in exciting experiences. There's always something new to discover. Are you ready? Download June's Journey now on Android or iOS.
All right, everyone, welcome back to another episode of Friends from Work, a podcast about all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And it's hosted by me, Kyle Sconewill, and him, Robbie Earl. Today is jam-packed, just jam-packed. It's almost as jam-packed as the rest of our 2021 is going to be.
Yep.
I am ready. I am ready to bring it today. I have so many things to talk about, so much excitement. Robbie, are you ready?
I'm ready. You know, we're getting into the Christmas season, and in some ways, I like Christmas Eve more than Christmas just because the anticipation is so fun. And right now I feel like we're at No Way Home Eve. These are going to be our last few episodes before we're meeting up to see No Way Home in theaters 1 week from today as we're recording this.
Mm-hmm.
And man, you're right. We keep saying that everything's jam-packed, but holy cow. Like this episode is not even about No Way Home and it's still jam-packed.
This has been as bonkers as we predicted it would be. We are pouring every extra second we have into this podcast, and I'm loving every bit of it. We have the two sides going on still. Hawkeye is crushing it, and so many things associated with that are so much fun. And yep. Spider-Man is crushing it, and so much stuff on that side of things. Holy cow, can't wait to get into it. Like you said, one more week. So that's a perfect transition into, I need to reiterate our schedule for everybody, okay? Just so we're on the same page here.
This is actually helpful for me as well.
Yeah. Just so that Robbie doesn't miss a recording date. Let me say this for everybody. One, today we're going to be chatting about Hawkeye Episode 4. We're also taking a few of your guys' questions that you called in and left us about Spider-Man. And we chatted with the Christoph Beck. And you'll hear in my intro, I'm not going to fanboy now because you get a lot of it in that interview. But holy cow, Robbie can attest, this is maybe the most excited I've ever been an interview. Christoph Beck is the composer of WandaVision. He's the composer of Frozen. He's the composer of Ant-Man. And he's the composer of Hawkeye. And as many people know out there, probably my current favorite, at least when we did our power rankings, I think he was like two or three of the first four picks between you and I. So it's a blast. It's a fun conversation. So that's today, Robbie.
This is one of those things that people may or may not know because we do get excited about all these guests we have on legitimately. We're not faking that or anything. But there are certain guests that behind the scenes, Kyle and I will tell our manager, Pete, our kind of dream gets, like folks that we would be just over the moon to talk to. And Christoph Beck has been one of those for nearly a year now. This was a moment long in the making, and it was everything that we could have asked for. Christoph was such a blast to talk to. We think y'all are really, really, really going to enjoy this one, so stick around for that.
If you like to watch that interview, go to the ffwpodcast.com/watch or click on watch, and the full video is there as well. But that's just today. Next Monday, so Monday, December 13, we are going to have our complete Spider-Man reflection episode for all of y'all. So this is us reflecting on the Tobey Maguire stuff, the Andrew Garfield stuff, and the Tom Holland stuff, and what is our big takeaway from all of these entries of Spider-Man. And I think we've come up with a few fun ways to discuss that.
Yep.
So I'm equally as excited about that.
We are also on that episode going to be joined by a fellow podcast host of the Amazing Spider Talk, Dan Gavazdin, who I'm really excited to talk to because he is a Spider-Man aficionado, if there ever was one. And he is also a student of film, and I think is going to bring a really, really fun perspective to that conversation. So be sure to tune in for that.
No doubt. The day after that comes out, I am packing my bags and I am flying to Austin, Texas to watch Spider-Man No Way Home with one of my best pals, Robbie Earle.
And to get some Torchies.
And to get some Torchies tacos. I just got chills thinking about my Austin trip right now. You just gave me goosebumps. Unbelievable. Going to be so much fun. Robbie and I's plan is to record our initial reactions episode immediately after we walk out of the theater. So this will be the most fresh initial reactions we've ever had. And I'm imagining they're going to be quite bold. It's going to be a lot. Let's put it that way. A lot of initial reactions. But then earlier in that day, we are also recording our Hawkeye episode 5 reaction because Hawkeye now is getting crazy. There's a lot of plates to balance over there. So our goal is to have the Hawkeye episode 5 come out on Wednesday evening, probably December 15th. And then Spider-Man initial reactions, December 16th. And then let's not forget that the finale of Hawkeye is the following Wednesday, December 22. And we'll have our episode out either that night or on Thursday, December 23. And then let's all go take a little holiday break. Let's relax a little. We'll sleep. We'll kick our legs up like Hawkeye has to. We'll ice our feet and we'll figure out how we're going to regroup. We're like a sprinter going to the finish, you know, with arms out, chest out to try to get a photo finish. That's us right now. My last housekeeping thing, in the spirit of Christmas, like we've said so many times, Oprah, Santa Claus, let's go. Our last final $50 Cinemark gift card winner is Alexander Clifford.
Woo!
Let's go. Wow. So like I said last week, to be entered into this gift card giveaway, you had to buy some of our merch, which Alexander did using the promo code Cinemark. So thank you, Alexander. I hope you enjoy your merch. And more importantly, I hope you enjoy your Cinemark $50 gift card. It's not too late for you guys to get your merch if you're still wanting to be a part of that. I am selling the hoodies pretty quickly. I'm about to get them. I'm really, really racing with the printing company to make sure you guys have your hoodies by Spider-Man. I don't know if I'll make that deadline. I promise you'll have them by Christmas, but we're working on it, and I can't wait for y'all to see them. So you can go to the ffwpodcast.com/merch if you want to check those out. I'm closing the merch store on December 23rd when Hawkeye's done, right before Christmas. So you have about 2 more weeks to get your orders in, and I'll get them to you, and then we're closing it down. Okay, Robbie, now, time to transition. Let's get into our voice message section where we take a few phone calls from our beloved listeners. And let me just add, we are so thankful for everybody that called in right before this conversation. Robbie and I were talking on the phone about how blown away we are that you guys would call in and leave messages. And we love hearing from you. So thank you for doing that. So without further ado, Robbie, let's play our first Spider-Man No Way Home question from one of our listeners.
Hi, Kyle. Hi, Robbie. This is Ryan calling in. My question for you guys is, what are your thoughts on the release of the new Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse trailer and its timing? The movie doesn't come out for almost another year, and yet we already have a trailer. Do you think this may hint at Miles Morales coming in No Way Home, or maybe even What If Season 2? I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Your guys' show is great. Thank you. Have a good one.
Wow. Okay. First off, great question from Ryan. Also, I think we mentioned this last time. If you have not seen that trailer yet, you should go see it because it looks incredible, which is not a surprise. That is really interesting. That trailer came out so early. We're finding out it's a part one. There's a lot sort of dig into on that side whenever we have time. But yeah, that is sort of the one of the big question marks here. We're getting potentially other Spider-Men. We're definitely getting call-outs to other Spider-Man universes, and you know, including Venom. So the only one that we have not had a clear connection to yet is the animated Miles Spider-Verse. And as I think I've said before, the reason I think that it's a good question is because whether this is just a marketing thing or not, you know, whenever Venom came out, at the end of Venom, there's a little cue that came on in the theaters that's like in another universe, and then it jumps to into the Spider-Verse. So it was almost setting up like the fact that Venom is part of that multiverse. And so then if Venom is part of also the MCU's multiverse, does that kind of by extension include this stuff? I ultimately think, I don't think Miles is going to show up here. I think the MCU is going to wind up doing Miles its own way down the line, which I'm really excited about.
I think I am in total lockstep with you here. The non-conspiracy part of my brain says they're probably just putting the trailer out so that they can capitalize on the marketing of Spider-Man right now.
Right.
And the excitement of that. The conspiracy part of my brain does agree with the question a little bit, which is, it is a little strange to get so much emphasis on Miles right now, a year out.
Right.
Could they be hinting at Miles in the MCU? We have seen hints of that already in Homecoming.
Mm-hmm. True.
And so I do think it's possible. And yet, I don't think they'll do it here just because of what you're saying. I think they're going to do a full Miles story more in depth later. So at maximum, I'm guessing we're just going to get a shout out to that. And then later, we'll get a full Miles story.
Right. To your point about them capitalizing on the moment, isn't it crazy how much is happening? Like, we're not doing a What's New in the MCU section this week because we have a million other things to do, but we could do
this
a whole
kind of
What's
that.
New in the MCU. Right. I mean, we could do a whole episode on it because just in the past week, I think, we got the clip from Morbius that came out. We had Jared Leto say, oh, well, you know, the multiverse is open, so now anything could happen, which, again,
right.
You're like, well, does that mean there's a connection or are they just trying to sell Morbius tickets? And then also Kevin Feige came out right after we had that conversation last week about Daredevil and Kingpin and said,
right.
Charlie Cox is coming to the MCU as Daredevil at some point in some way. All of this coming out the week ahead of Spider-Man No Way Home, which already has a million rumors rolling around it.
Right. It makes me wonder, are we just going to fall off a cliff after this in January? I mean, do we want to save any of this, please? Anyways, I love the question. So much going on. What a time to be alive for an MCU fan. Our next question is from Brandon.
Hey, this is Brandon Klein from Mingo County, West Virginia. My question is, do you guys, I guess it's a comment or how y'all think about this, about Norman Osborn never being a part of the MCU since we're getting him apart from another universe? Do you ever think they'll have these characters have an MCU version of Norman Osborn they'll replace some way down the line? So thanks. Great podcast. Love y'all. Bye.
Well, you know I love this question because I've wanted a Norman Osborn in the MCU for a long time. I think they're still going to do a Norman Osborn in the MCU at some point that is separate from Willem Dafoe. I do think that's going to happen. It might be a long time, though, because of the constant rights thing we're talking about.
Right.
As you've reminded me, Sony owns not just Spider-Man, they own a lot of these Spider-Man properties, including Norman Osborn. So I'm guessing that's one reason that Marvel has shied away from Oscorp entirely, almost.
Right.
Whereas the other Spider-Man movies focus so much on Oscorp, mm-hmm. you know, so much. And I think that Marvel has, A, wanted to differentiate themselves from those movies, which they've done so well, and we'll talk about next Monday a ton. But B, I do think rights-wise, they figure, hey, we might as well stay away from it. So we're differentiating ourselves, and we might as well not mess with the rights. All that being said, that's a long-winded way of saying I don't think they're going to do it soon, but I do think that Norman Osborn is too recognizable of a character for Spider-Man to have him never exist in the MCU.
Yeah, I think that's right. What I'm curious about is if we could get a version of Norman Osborn in the MCU that's sort of what you and I have talked about as being modeled after that Bendis Dark Avengers era. Like, since we've, with a version of Norman Osborn we've gotten is much more classic, like old school Green Goblin nemesis Norman Osborn. And in the 2000s, whether you like it or not, Norman Osborn kind of took on a much bigger role within the Marvel Universe. And I think that's one of the things you and I would like to see happen. And so it'll be, I'm interested to see if they go that route to kind of differentiate it from what's come before.
I want to tag on one other thing here, because we got multiple questions about the Sinister Six as well, which I'm tagging because of Green Goblin. Mm-hmm. We didn't choose to play one of those here, but we got a few calls about it and a few people wrote in about it. And basically the question there is, we do see Norman Osborn and Green Goblin in the trailer, and we've seen Electro, we've seen Sandman, we've seen Lizard, and we've seen Doc Ock, but that's five. So two-parter here, Robbie. Who is going to be the sixth, prediction-wise? And then, as a fun side note, who would you choose for your Sinister Six just for fun? And I can answer first, since you entered first last time. I don't know who the sixth person's going to be in this movie. A, I think it's a possibility that they stick with just five people, although that would be kind of intentionally cruel. B, I don't think it's going to be Vulture, because I almost wonder if they're setting up a twist with Vulture specifically where he's kind of half good going forward. Again, this is all prediction. I don't think it's going to be him. I don't think they're going to bring back Mysterio, just because I haven't heard any rumblings of that. It would be a crazy twist because these people are dead, I guess. So I don't know the sixth person.
Yeah.
And then let me say, based off all the portrayals I've seen, my ideal Sinister Six, I think, would be mainly cutting out the animal-based villains. So I think I'd go
Doc Ock?
No. Well, no, that's not full animal. I mean, like Lizard, Scorpion.
Oh, okay.
Fair. I would kind of, so here's mine. I'm just going to go, this is partially based off the game too. You know, I'm a sucker for that. So I would go Green Goblin, Doc Ock for sure. I would go Martin Lee as Mr. Negative. I think that's a really story there. Deep cut, I know. I'd go Vulture, number four. I'd go Mysterio, number five, because of how they've portrayed him here. And number six, I'd probably say Tinkerer. Deep cut. Wow. Maybe not the MCU version of Tinkerer, but more like the Miles Morales video game Tinkerer.
Yeah.
So I guess I'd go Green Goblin, Tinkerer, Doc Ock, Vulture, Mysterio, and Mr. Negative.
Wow. So my gut still says the sixth person might be Venom.
Ooh, right. Yeah, it could be.
Just because, like, and I know some folks are sure, and I would not be surprised if this is the case, that that's sort of a red herring and that Venom is just going to show up barely in this, which I'm fine with. But I still feel like it's such an intentional moment in Let There Be Carnage. And he does seem in that scene to be hostile towards Spider-Man.
Right.
So it makes sense to me. However, I will say, especially since you just brought up the Tinkerer, I keep wondering, the more and more we see Stark Tech seemingly incorporated into these villains, I wonder if the Tinkerer and or Vulture aren't going to be involved in that process, like in somehow upgrading Electro and Green Goblin and Doc Ock.
Oh, for them. Okay.
Yeah. Because, I mean, it's just like, that seems like it would be such a natural move given their role in Homecoming. And, you know, like, if that is what's happening and they're somehow winding up with Stark Tech, I can't think of a better explanation.
Then briefly, what would be your ideal six?
So yeah, my ideal six, it's sort of hard because I've got the comic one stamped in my head.
Sure, but that counts. You can say that.
But one thing that I appreciate about the classic Sinister Six is that they're all fairly grounded, at least at the time. Like, I know we've had certain adaptations now of Electro and Sandman, like we've talked about, where it's like, holy cow, how do you ever beat something like this? But at the time, there was a sense that Spider-Man could kind of punch his way out. It was just, the problem was, like, each villain would pose its own unique problem that he had to solve. But then also it was just the sheer number of them. So I'm kind of different from you. I think I would be happy to see Vulture come back as an original member. I think I would like to see Scorpion come back, even though he's not an original member. But I just like the kind of grounded part of the way that character was set up in Homecoming. And then I think I'd like Doc Ock being there. I like Electro being there. I like Sandman being there within reason. So I think that's five. I think I said Doc Ock, Scorpion, Vulture, Sandman, Electro, and then my final one, I think, would be Mysterio.
Yeah,
because he's a classic member again, and I would not be upset at all if Quentin Beck came back. That's one of those deaths that I don't think it was supposed to be a super emotional moment, so I don't think anything would be really undone in the way we've talked about with like Loki and Vision. I think it would just be very in keeping with that character. The only reason I don't say Green Goblin there, by the way, is just because I really like the Green Goblin being sort of in his own lane with Spider-Man. Like in the comics, you don't see him team up all that often because it's like it's very personal. And that's a great, like we actually got a comment to that effect this week in that villains panel that you referenced last episode, where Jamie Foxx was pointing out that that's what makes Willem Dafoe's performance so intriguing in No Way Home, is that it's a very different kind of relationship. And Tom Holland's talked about how those scenes are a lot more intense and scarier, and it's just a very different style of action. And that makes me excited because I feel like even if he is part of this quote unquote Sinister Six that they're building, it seems like they're really maintaining that, like, the Green Goblin Spider-Man relationship is a special kind of a thing that's kind of darker and in some ways more intense than any other.
Okay, and we got a fun question about, do we think you could see a new Andrew Garfield Spider-Man movie and whatnot, which I think is a fun question, but we're going to save that for next Monday because I think we're going to talk a little bit about that in the Spider-Man Omnibus episode on Monday, okay? So our third and final question is from one of our loyal listeners, Greg. Here you go.
Hey, guys, it's the other Greg. I was just wondering, since Spider-Man No Way Home seems to be the most spoiler-ridden trailers and movie in history, how do you guys handle spoilers or avoiding spoilers? And if you do happen to catch a spoiler or two, how do you address them? What kind of credit do you give them? All right, talk to you guys later. Keep up the good work.
We chose this one because it's kind of a unique question for us. I'll first say that in general, avoiding spoilers has gotten harder now that we are doing this podcast, because I used to be able to just turn my phone off when it came to anything social media around a movie. So if I even saw a word trending, I would just cancel. I'd close Twitter. However, now it's a little interesting because we want to also be prepared to talk to you guys about stuff while not having stuff spoiled. So I'll say that the challenge has gotten a little greater since we've started this. However, I'll also say for me, it's a little bit easier because on my personal social media, I don't follow a ton of the spoilery type accounts because we follow a lot of those on our friends from work social media. And so my social media is full of sports people and friends and whatever. And so I don't even see some of this stuff. When I switch over to friends from work, yeah, it's a challenge. I have to avoid the spoilers by just being incredibly careful what you view as you're scrolling down. Like if I see, like for example, I saw that Clint was trending when I woke up at like 7 a.m. and I had not seen Hawkeye yet. And I was like, nope, that's it. Turn it off. I don't want to see another follow-up to that because I knew that's why it was trending. So it's just an active attempt at shutting it down. And lastly, let me add, my wife hates spoilers more than even me. So if I even say, hey, Annika, I saw Hawkeye and it was really good, she'll go, don't tell me that. Why would you even say it was good? Now I'm going in thinking it's going to be bad. So she's entirely shut off our conversation beforehand. So she helps keep me accountable when it comes to spoilers.
Man, I'm kind of with Annika there. I hate it so much when something's spoiled. And I actually had to turn off Instagram notifications back during WandaVision because we talked about this. I woke up one morning and at like 6 a.m. we had a message from someone being like, isn't it so crazy that Pietro showed back up, but it wasn't? And I was like, oh my gosh. And I had to like, luckily I didn't actually spoil the Evan Peters thing, but like, so I really try to like do the, if I see something, I like bounce my eyes away. But it is hard because we are also trying to kind of cover the news to some degree. So I will say this is maybe another time to plug the Slack, because that's been a good way for me, because we have folks there. One, also, I love that this question came from, quote unquote, the other Greg.
Right. Inside jokes.
Because Greg of the Slack has become so famous. And folks like Greg are really great about sifting through a lot of the rumors and things, and putting things that would be spoilers into spoiler threads that you can avoid. So for me, I've started, like, whenever Hawkeye comes up on a new episode and I haven't seen it yet, I just mute that channel in the Slack. And so you can hang out there and you can talk about stuff and you can hear stuff that's happening that is not spoilery without being at risk. So that is both kind of how I've avoided them, and an invitation for you to join.
But yeah, I think a lot of our listeners have tickets to this movie opening night, or at least opening weekend. So you really only have to make it like another 10 days. So hopefully you can do that, avoid social media, and then, oh my goodness, we can all watch it together and start talking about the long-term implications of Spider-Man No Way Home. Okay, Robbie, we need to dive into Hawkeye Episode 4, which I thought was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
So let's do that after a quick word from some of our sponsors.
All right, Kyle, look, we have got to dive into this. We don't have time to mess around. So I'm just going to say this week's episode is entitled Partners, Am I Right? We've got the same cast coming back with the notable addition of Florence Pugh, which is very
fun.
Here
we go.
I'm going to list this first in honor of today's interview. This episode is again scored by Christoph Beck, and I would say maybe one of my favorite scores of his within this episode, for reasons we talk about in that interview. This one was written by Heather Quinn and Aaron Concino, and it was directed by Bert and Bernie. So let's get into it.
Something I'm enjoying that we've started doing recently on these episodes is, before we go through it kind of chronologically, let's talk about some of the lingering questions really quickly, because it's on everyone's mind.
What kind of pizza was Lucky eating?
That is exactly what everyone's talking about. That's the spoiler I couldn't avoid. Everyone's talking about pizza. If it's not pepperoni, he's doing it wrong. It's a New York slice, people. By the way, Remember how I felt about Spider-Man 3 with the deep dish? Come on. Come on. Deep dish pizza, my butt. Robbie, let's talk about this first dynamic between Jack, Kate, and Kate's mom.
Yep.
What's going on here? I feel like I'm not getting more clarity here, which I love. I love the ambiguity of it. Tell me if I'm crazy on this. Did you almost sense this time around that Jack pulled the sword on Clint and he was almost pissed at him? And then when Kate's mom walked in and goes, oh, that's an Avenger, he like put on his act of like, oh, I didn't even know Archer. Like it seemed like I got two different versions of Jack there. The first version recognized it was Clint, but he was pissed and was going to actually do something. And then when he realized he was being watched by Kate's mom, he changed personas. Am I crazy?
No, that's a good catch. I mean, because it definitely seemed, whether it was just them setting up the cliffhanger or an intentional story move. Yeah, I mean, he seems like in that, also just like to, I know that he's a sword guy, that he's into swords, but to like pull a sword on a person, like I get that he probably thought they were trespassing, but that's still such a weird thing to do, like to hold a sword to someone's neck.
Right. But then we later find that he is CEO of this company with the Tracksuit Mafia.
Right.
So that kind of confirms he's bad, unless that intel is wrong. But then it just makes me wonder, like, why is he being so weird here? And what is Kate's mom's role? Like when Kate's mom pulls Hawkeye aside and says, please don't let Kate get hurt. Do you buy that as genuine? Like, was that a genuine moment from a mother that's concerned about her daughter? Or like, what was that? Am I reading too much into that?
I feel like there was maybe some of that in there. Like, I think she does actually care about Kate, but I think it was also her wanting him to just drop it in general to protect herself potentially.
Right, because then right after that, she makes the mysterious phone call, presumably right. maybe to Kingpin. But what is Jack and Kate's mom's relationship then? Are they both aware of this plan and they're both acting like they don't? That's where I'm at with the show right now.
Yeah, so it's funny, right? Because last week we ended saying that, oh, well, it looks like we're finally going to get some clarity on Jack this time around. And we absolutely, I mean, we did in some ways because we got this answer that he runs the shell company. But at the same time, we got the scene where he's being really sweet and you see Kate kind of coming around to him. And so it's like they further complicated things really more than providing any clarity.
Right. Right.
Which I love.
So my next major question then is the one everyone's talking about. Why does Laura know about the watch? What the heck when she jumps into German as code language? And who is Clint ultimately trying to protect with that watch? I'm talking specifically about this scene here.
I've been wondering, verschwinde nach mir auf dem Gelände?
You mean the Rolex?
You know, it's dead.
I don't think so. I don't think so. Why?
Wasn't it destroyed like years ago?
Well, I thought so, but I thought the same thing about your fancy outfit.
Well, it's worth looking into, isn't it?
If you can, check the signal from the transmitter.
So what's going on here? I've seen rumors on our Slack about Laura is actually an ex-SHIELD agent, or she's actually a superhero called Mockingbird I've never heard of. Or maybe it's not Laura with the watch that he's trying to protect. Like, then I'm trying to rack my brain. If he's referencing that Laura has been out of the game for 15 years, but now back in, which would kind of make sense because Laura helps him with a ton of stuff. But then, did they already have that undercover when they got introduced to S.H.I.E.L.D. in Age of Ultron? Because in Age of Ultron, Hawkeye says, S.H.I.E.L.D. helped me keep this family off the books. So they were already off the books there, I guess. I don't, like, what's going on there? What's your take?
Yeah, I am hesitant to go down the Laura is a secret agent road.
Me too. I just don't think that would be appropriate for this, kind of.
Yeah, there are a couple of reasons. One, I don't like it when things are so blatantly retconned.
Amen.
And I know we're living in comic book movie TV world, but you know what I mean? Like, there's been no sign of that ever.
Right, that she's ever been an agent.
And I think that was part of the beauty of the character, right? Is that he has this, he's split. Like, one half of his life is so crazy.
Yes. Amen.
And so kind of like beyond imagining, and then the other side is it's like grounded, and I don't want to take that away.
Right. And remember when we were talking about Falcon Winter Soldier and the big question was who's the power broker, and then we said, are you going to be disappointed if it's Sharon? And then it turned out to be Sharon.
Right.
That's a teeny bit how I feel here. Like, I don't need a twist from every character where it's like they're also a super secret spy.
Right.
And you're so right. The best part of Hawkeye is that tension between him being a super secret spy, but really wanting a farmhouse family life totally off the books. And to have her be a part of that, I'm not saying it's bad. I just don't know that I'll love it. So if it's not her then, though, is this going to be like WandaVision with the aerospace engineer where we all guess, is it somebody we know? Is it Laura? Is it some other major character like Charlie Cox? I almost wondered for a second, like he's been out of the game for 15 years, maybe.
I did wonder that. I think he'd be too young for that.
Okay. Well, because I thought maybe that'd be a way to bring someone in like that and explain why they haven't been here. Like, maybe they're going to introduce a new character now, and this is how they get by the, where were you during all this?
Right. But
then I'm like, is it going to be an aerospace engineer where it's just some other person, an actor we don't even know, and it's going to be a letdown? I don't know. Oh, gosh. That's
well, and what's the significance of the watch itself? You know, like, why is it a watch? Why is it a classic Rolex? Like, does that give us any hint about who this person would be?
Well, and it's giving off a GPS signal. So it's not a normal Rolex.
Right.
Because they were able to track it. So at first people thought, is it a Stark time control watch? And I don't think it's that because it doesn't look similar enough. But why would a watch be so important otherwise?
Yeah, and the Mockingbird thing is, I get why people are going there, because in the comics, Clint is married to Bobby Morse, who is Mockingbird, who actually was also kind of adapted in the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. show. I could see that. I don't know really what role that character would play at this moment, given all of the other, like, if you look at the relationship that I think Clint and Mockingbird had in the comics, if they were to try to put that now into the MCU, I think it would be strange, because on the one hand, like, we've got Clint and Laura, that's its own thing. We had Clint and Natasha, which was his own relationship, and then we have Clint and Kate. So he's got all these women in his life that he has, like, very unique and I think really meaningful relationships with. I just don't know, like, what role, like, I guess what I'm saying is, based on how I've seen that relationship portrayed in the comics, it seems like they're already mining that just with different characters. And so I've seen some people say, well, yeah, maybe Laura is Mockingbird. And that would just be interesting because the MCU normally, with some exceptions, like with Iron Man 3 and the Mandarin, does kind of stick to people's normal alter egos and stuff. So unless they were going to say, like, Laura is like a new code name, like Witness Protection or something, and she was always Bobby Morse. But my final thing on that, to go very back to whenever you first asked this question, I just don't think the conversation you just played really hints that, like, Laura doesn't seem worried enough for it to be about her personally. Like, she's concerned, but she's not like, oh my gosh, I am personally about to be found out and thrust into this concerned.
Right, like, oh, don't let that get out. Yeah. I don't know. We'll get more answers coming up, I'm sure. The last, like, really obvious question of what's going on, then we can go through a few little things in the episode. Yelena, at the end, massive reveal. So much fun. Love the connection to Black Widow. But a question a lot of people are discussing is, how much does Clint know about Yelena, Yelena's connection to the Black Widow program, Yelena's connection to Natasha? And then, if you want to get really detailed, did Clint even see it was Yelena? So here's why I bring this up. When Yelena zaps him with the widow's bite thing, Clint is forced to, like, look away, and you can see on a screenshot that he's like, ah, and he can't see that she then turns her back and reveals herself to Kate, who would obviously not know who that is. Then she jumps off the cliff. So did Nat post Black Widow and post Nat stopping the Red Room, did she ever fill in Clint in this other time about finishing the Red Room program and what happened to the other widows or not? So does Clint just think this is a widow because of the widow's bite, but he has no idea that Yelena's at all unique to Natasha? Or does Clint know about what happened in that movie and that's how they're going to reconcile with Yelena?
Yeah, that's the really interesting question, because on the one hand, you would think, well, they were so close and Clint was so involved in shutting down ostensibly the Black Widow program initially that you think Nat would have updated him. But at the same time, you think about whenever they reunited and it had been, what, like 7 years since then? By the time they come back and, like, the blips happened and Thanos, and then they're coming back for this specific reason and he's gone through all the Ronin stuff. And I could just see it going either way. Like, I guess I could see them, like, in Avengers Compound catching up. But I could also see them not, you know, like, and just being like, we're doing the job that we have to do. So regardless, I don't know that Clint would personally know or recognize Yelena. Like, I don't know. Do you think Nat would have been like, by the way, my sister, I also, like, she's freed now, and here's a picture of her. And so, you know, if you see her, you know. Like, I don't know if they ever would have gone that far.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it seems logical if they were as close as they were that there'd be some moment for her to be like, I had another family. But I don't know that she'd go as far as to say, here's a picture. Wave to her if you ever see her.
But you know what's interesting is whenever Cap asks that, or Tony asks that, I forget, in Endgame, I think it's Tony. Like, did she have any family?
That's so true. And Clint doesn't say that. Yeah. So then I'm thinking, why would Natasha not? You know, first of all, I would say they don't have a ton of time to talk about it. You know, maybe they said something on the trip to Vormir.
that's what I thought. I mean, because they are kind of like joking and reminiscing. And they talk about Budapest there. So it's just kind of crazy to think about when you put Black Widow back in its timeline. Because Black Widow within the MCU would have taken place in 2016. And Endgame is 2023, right?
Mm-hmm. You're more the timeline guy than me, but yeah.
I think that's right. And so someone can correct me if it's 22 or something. But either way, that is like, it's not like she would be like, oh my gosh, this thing just happened necessarily. But then again, Clint was so tied up with it that, yeah, I could see it going either way. I do think it's interesting that he doesn't see her face, though, to your point.
Right. Well, and just remember that Clint was on that original mission to stop the Red Room. Right. So I feel like if she was going to follow up on it with anybody, it would be, hey, Clint, by the way, we never stopped it. There was a whole nother Red Room, you know. But
that's a good point. Even whenever he makes the you know, we've come a long way from Budapest joke, that was maybe right after that, she was like, oh, man, by the way, I've got to tell you some stuff.
Right, right.
Speaking of.
Okay, so those are obviously the biggest lingering questions. So let's just go back and point out a few other fun things in the episode that are not as big. I need to say something right off the bat. The texting in this show is the worst texting I've ever seen. I don't know if you noticed this, but in the second episode, when Kate is texting Clint, she's pushing like 3 buttons and like 1,000 words are coming out. I'm like, there's no way she's texting that. Then here, it shows Clint texting Laura, and he never hits send, and the message just goes. How does
he
do that?
That's really funny.
It's so frustrating to me. Represent texting better, please.
On the little detail front, in terms of something that I liked in this episode, did you notice, having read the first 5 issues of that Hawkeye run, that there was the line where Clint said, I was a weapon, which is a direct callback to the first arc in that Matt Fraction run being called My Life as a Weapon?
How about this? You ready for this Easter egg?
Yeah.
I noticed that Kate is wearing a similar shirt to the shirt she is in one of the comics.
Yes. Yeah. That's also nice. Boomerang Arrow, another shout out.
Oh, not only a shout out to the comics, but actually genuinely funny to me. Which is like, because they'd come back. He's like, but they'd be coming back at us. She's like, well, then you wouldn't run out of trick arrows. You just have to dodge it a little bit. Which I thought was amazing. The family dynamic, I love it. I love how weird it is. It has WandaVision vibes where something just feels off. So when they're having that sweet moment dancing in front of Kate early on in the episode, I don't know how to feel. I feel so uneasy. Like, I think they want us to feel like it's a sweet moment, but I feel unsettled because something's not right still. So it's hard for me to buy fully into the sweetness, but I think that's what they want. But I just thought that was so unique how weird it is.
Yeah. No, I felt that way too. I thought it was interesting, like, they focus a lot on Kate smiling to kind of clue you into, like, she's now kind of coming around because she's seeing her mom kind of soften, which I think means a lot to her. And I do like that because, like, one episode ago, had Clint been like, oh man, you were totally right about Jack, she would have been like, yes. And now she's like, oh. Because now she's like, well, I actually like seeing my mom happy. And that means now that I've got to kind of take that away. So I liked that scene. I thought that, like, that whole first chunk of the episode was fun. I liked the, like, thank you, by the way, for saving the world, and all that stuff. I just like the kind of, I've liked all of this post-Endgame, just people sort of having an awareness now of what the Avengers did and, you know, having that conversation with Clint in person. I really, like, my favorite part of the episode for sure was the kind of Christmas movie night that Clint and Kate have. that was one of my favorite moments. I think that 10 minutes or however long it was in the entire post-Endgame era. I just like, I feel like Renner and Haley Steinfeld were really like the chemistry was right. It was just like, and it was funny, like you said, like the Boomerang Arrow stuff. I liked him teaching, like showing off and then teaching her the like coin trick.
He's opening up. All,
yeah, it was just, it was so like, and it was so great. Like her trying to kind of give him what he's missing with his family, I thought was really sweet. It was the perfect balance of all things. And then it culminates. And the real, I mean, what's really the high point of the episode for me is this conversation that they have about Natasha.
About the time I met someone, I was sent to take her out. And when I got there, when it was time, I couldn't do it. I just had this feeling that she wanted out. Turns out I was right.
You mean Natasha?
Yeah. She was the best there was.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. It's, when you do what I do for a living, it, it's just a game of managing loss, right? So.
Yeah, it's such a sweet moment. Everything you said is true. I bought all the chemistry. I love that Clint's opening up to Kate a little bit, which is perfect for how the episode finishes when he closes off finally because it got too serious. So I love that, like, he's just now getting open, which allows Kate to feel like she's finally getting in, only to get the door slammed in her face. So I like that dynamic. And then obviously I got to point out the callback there to the Infinity War and Endgame musical moment with Even For You from Alan Silvestri,
yeah,
which
one of my favorite tracks from that score, by the way.
Absolutely. But I'm not going to go into it like crazy because we talk about it with Christoph Beck. I mean, what a better way. I mean, Robbie, that's the ultimate trump card. I'm like, hey, I'm going to talk about it in a second, but here, let me just have Christoph Beck tell you about it. So that's what we're doing. But yeah, I love that scene. That was definitely the high point of the episode. One of the high points of the series as well.
Now, I will say for me, and not like, I'm not saying it was bad, but the part after this, whenever they kind of break and, like, I like the Kazi scene. I thought that was fun. Her meeting up with the LARPers, something just didn't, like, I don't know if it was a pacing thing. I don't think that the acting was off. It was just something, it didn't quite click. Like, it felt like the episode took a little bit of a swerve there. And for me, it wasn't as dialed in as it had been up until that point.
You know what I think you may be feeling is that when Kate shows up, at first, she's kind of almost making fun of them. Almost where it's like, wow, you guys got a lot going on and so cool. And so then you're kind of like, oh, is this from a, hey, she thinks it's goofy and she's making fun of it. And then like just like 10 seconds later, she's bought in. And I can't tell if the LARPers are just so dumb that they're not aware that what they're doing is kind of goofy. But then all of a sudden they're just so bought into the new costume thing. I'm with you. It wasn't my favorite part of the episode. I'm not even saying it's bad either, but something felt a little bit off there. I just wonder if the shift in tone of their relationship happened so quickly and then Clint being so weirded out by it without any background. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I'd love it our listeners to tell us. What are we missing there?
Yeah, but one question I legitimately have is, well, two questions actually. One, and this is maybe an easy answer and I'm just forgetting from last week. Why are the trick arrows in a police holding facility? Do you know that?
I don't know that. That's a legitimately good question because we obviously saw them have some of them at least an episode ago. What are we missing, listeners? Did they lose more arrows? Question mark. Maybe It's just that that was all the trick arrows they had, and the rest are from Avengers Compound that were picked up by the police as weapons, or I don't know.
Well,
I don't
maybe,
know.
Maybe they used all the trick arrows to take down Maya's Dodge Charger, and the police then confiscated the Charger, and therefore everything kind of attached, like the everything attached to that entire kind of bridge,
maybe
car chase fight scene. Maybe that's what's happening.
I thought a more interesting question than that was, who was making his trick arrows? Was that a reference to Tony? Like when he says we don't have them anymore.
That's what I assumed.
That Stark was making them.
Yeah, but you know what's weird about that? I think maybe it's that S.H.I.E.L.D. and Stark, like S.H.I.E.L.D. then Stark, because he had
them in
Avengers.
Well, because Age of Ultron time, Stark is S.H.I.E.L.D., basically.
Well, or the first Avengers. I feel like Age of Ultron, it would have been Tony, because Tony talks about how he is building everyone's gear at that point.
Sorry, to clarify, that's what I mean. In the first Avengers, there's clearly a Tony camp and a S.H.I.E.L.D. camp, so Tony's not making tech for them. By the time we get to Age of Ultron, he is the whole tech department. He has outfitted all of the Avengers with that stuff. So somewhere in there, I'm saying.
Oh, right. I see what you're saying. So I think that's maybe where that's coming from. My other question is like less big picture. I'm just wondering, wasn't that officer, like that police officer, really, really quick to sign up to like quote unquote tamper with evidence?
Yeah. I'm guessing it's because it's for an Avenger, but she bought in from just Kate's word.
Yeah. Like I just thought it was interesting. Kate's like, Hawkeye sent me, we need you to break into a police holding facility and get stuff for us. And she was like, yeah, I'll do that.
Yeah. I would be more willing to buy it if it had been Hawkeye directly asking.
Right.
But this random girl with a bow and arrow is like, yeah, Hawkeye sent me. Go get it. I agree. Yeah. Yep. A little bit there. Couple other things. The bag saying bombshell. That's got to be an Easter egg of some sort. Or is it just that that's a funny thing? Is there more to that?
There is a comic Easter egg thing. There was a character associated with Hawkeye, without going into it, way, way back, called Bombshell.
Okay, so I just guessed. I was like, that's such a random word to point out so intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
And then lastly, let's talk about the outro scene here. First of all, I thought the break into Maya's apartment was just a fun way to do that. You see Clint trying to teach her again, and it felt so much like that Matt Fraction comic that Kate just ignores the advice and does it her way anyways. It's such a fun balance for me where Kate looks up to Clint, but still is confident enough that she wants to do some things her way.
Right.
And then how she did it was really funny with the elevator and helping the guy with groceries. And then she kind of weirds the grocery guy out. Oh, I'm talking to an Avenger. Wow. And he's like, okay, lunatic. I liked all that. I liked the reveal of Maya. And I liked the reveal of Yelena as far as they both thought they were fighting Maya. Right? That was all kind of fun.
Uh-huh. Yeah, okay. I do have one more question, though, from the scene. I need to rewatch it, as is often the case. This fight scene, it was kind of, there was a point where I was trying to just figure out what folks' motivations were. Like, I know that Yelena, based on the Black Widow post-credit scene, has been sort of told to go after Hawkeye as kind of vengeance for Natasha. I do have a question that we can, you know, I'm going to wait and hold off till we get more time with her, because part of me is like, I feel like she would see through that and know that Hawkeye obviously didn't like murder Natasha, but that's a question for later.
Well, no, we do need to say that for a second, because I don't want to be a Debbie Downer on this whole plot point, but ever since I've seen that scene in Black Widow, I like that they're trying to tie them together, and it is an interesting thing, but I feel like Black Widow was about Yelena turning from what she couldn't control to now what she can control. And
yes,
she kind of turned from bad to good. And we never once got the vibe that she was dumb, or not even dumb, but naive.
Right.
And so it is a little strange to me ever since that movie that I'm like, she's naive enough to just be like, yeah, let's go kill this guy because he's responsible, without even being like, wait, like she could do any kind of research and find out they were friends. Right.
Right. Like I could, I would buy John Walker being talked into that, right?
100%.
A million percent. But yeah, I mean, Because I can even see if they are trying to build like a Dark Avengers or Thunderbolts thing. I could even see where she would be attracted to that as like, well, now I can kind of follow in Natasha's footsteps and sort of honor her legacy and try to be that myself. But this isn't that. Like, this isn't, like, this is, I'm curious to see because she wasn't, it doesn't seem like she was necessarily trying to kill anyone, although, I mean, she obviously had a gun. I mean, she ducks out at the end rather than, like, try to land a killing blow, I feel like. So I don't,
yeah.
I'm curious if there's more going on.
See, I think they're going to resolve it in this show, but I agree that the plot point's intriguing, but I also just think it doesn't really work perfectly as weirdly as, so even if they resolve it, I'll look back and be like, I don't know that I needed that one plot point. There was probably another way to have them connect, but it's not something that's a big deal. I'm not going to die in that soapbox. I'm okay with it. I like Yelena being around, so I'm super pumped to see her.
And I am excited for the inevitable conversation between her and Clint because
exactly.
You know, it seemed like we've talked a lot about how much we're exploring Clint's grief over Natasha, and this is the one person that can really relate to that.
Yeah, she'll see Clint's pain, you know, and then I think that could be the healing bridge there.
Right.
But anyways, as far as the motivations, I don't know that I buy that. Like, Yelena is trying to apprehend Hawkeye. Kate's just trying to help because there's two random people fighting Hawkeye and her. And Maya is seeing it as an opportunity to get Clint back because he was clearly lying to her last time and escaped. And so if you watch, Yelena and Maya actually punch each other a couple times where it's kind of like, get off, this is my thing. And then on top of all that, there's just also the heat of the moment thing where it's like, oh my gosh, we're all fighting each other, so I might as well punch you. So I didn't feel what you're feeling there.
Well, and I should clarify, it's not that I'm saying I don't get why they're fighting. It's that I was just like, there are a couple moments. And the only reason I'm sort of nitpicking here is because I felt like the action from like a story perspective in episode 3, we talked about being so excellent, the way that whole car chase scene unfolded. And this one just felt like a tad clunkier to me, even though it had really, really fun moments and that really fun reveal with Yelena. I was just kind of like the moment whenever Maya gets hit with the arrow and then just kind of leaves, I thought was sort of strange.
She was shot by an arrow.
Yeah, but it was like, one, it didn't seem like she was shot by it, but you don't see her like fall back like Boromir style where it's like, oh, this is like a huge issue. It's just almost like she looks at it. I feel like it was a little bit of a like, I'm a badass. Like, this doesn't even really affect me. But then she leaves. So I was like, well, did it affect you or did it not? And like, if you've got these people that you've been after right here, why are you just taking off?
I agree with what you're saying. I do think it felt like one tiny notch down in the footing department from the car chase scene, which the car chase scene had felt like a significant notch up from the Loki action for me.
Right.
And so this is one notch down. I agree with that. I was not nearly as bothered, though, by the things you're bringing up because I still think there was fun moments that helped redeem it. Like, the zip line thing was funny to me and believable and kind of fun. And I thought the flashbang arrow was cool. So there were still some fun things. And I really liked the moment of Kate falling down and then playing that theme again a little bit. And it was like a flashback for Clint of what happened the last time he was holding a woman over the edge. And she's saying, bring me up instead of let me go. I thought that was a really interesting.
And a partner.
And a partner, right? So, like, think about it. And that one, he's begging for Nat to not let go, and she wants to be let go. And here, Kate is saying, pull me up, and he has to let her go. And so I like that parallel. But I see what you're saying. It was a touch clunkier, no doubt. I think the thing that I'm most excited to see going forward now, as we kind of wrap this up, is there's a lot of stuff they're juggling here. Like, I don't have a bigger sense on the family dynamic. We still haven't seen Kingpin, and we don't know Yelena's involvement here, and is Maya going to give up this chase of Clint? There's a lot to go through for just two more episodes. And the last thing I want to add, Robbie, is I put my finger on something unique while watching this episode. Mm-hmm. I think one of my favorite things that the MCU does is whenever they give us moments that are so tension filled and I'm glued to the screen without a single bit of action. And mm-hmm. I'm realizing that's, to me, when the MCU is at its best. Let me give you some examples. I've always talked about how one of my favorite moments in the entire MCU is the Vulture and Spider-Man car ride scene, where there's not a single bullet fired, but it's so tense. You can't look away.
Right.
And I loved the tension at the end of Loki in the finale, just with the conversation with Kang. And I'm reminded of that because I feel like this show has done a pretty good job of that. Like, we haven't had to have the massive action sequences for me to still really feel some tension. And I wonder, is this show going to feel the need for these last two episodes to be super action heavy? Like, do you think this is going to come down to a massive bow and arrow shootout? And would we want that in the first place? Or is there a way for this to get resolved without a crazy fight and still be really tense?
That's a good question. I feel like we're going to get at least one more big one, whether it's in episode 5 or episode 6. We have to talk about the fact that Clint, you know, he did cut Kate loose. So they're going to have to, I ostensibly, have some kind of reconciliation by the end of the series. So I can imagine that happening maybe towards the end of episode 5 or at the beginning of episode 6, and then them having some kind of face-off. But I totally agree with your point here, and I was about to say the same thing. Like, what's kind of funny is I do think episode 3 as a whole is probably stronger.
So
but I struggle with that a little bit, though, because of how much I loved the quiet character moments in this one. Like, I really, really loved those. And so it's really hard for me to notch this down, even if I didn't think the action scenes were quite on par, just because I love that development. I like exactly what you're talking about. Like, I like the amount of intensity you can build without ever having to use any CGI.
Right. And lastly, I should add, I felt that same tension when she's exploring Maya's apartment and she found Clint's name on a notebook and the Avengers watch. Like, you're so tense, even though nothing's happened yet, because of what's going to happen. Which, by the way, is why I am so obsessed with WandaVision, because WandaVision was almost exclusively those moments. Like, when Wanda is finally confronting Monica Rambeau, saying, like, who are you? Why are you here? And, like, all that tension. Or, like, when the people outside are talking to Vision, it's like, she doesn't belong here. This is not her home. That's the kind of stuff that makes me love the MCU more than any of the fighting. So,
speaking of WandaVision and building emotional moments.
Yeah, true. We finally got to chat with Christoph Beck. So for those of you who don't know, Christoph Beck is the composer of WandaVision. He's the composer of Hawkeye. He's the composer of the Frozen stuff. He's also done Free Guy, Tower Heist, Ant-Man the Wasp, has a massive filmography. And it was an absolute pleasure to talk to him. We talked to him about some amazing things about WandaVision, Ant-Man, and about Hawkeye. You're not going to want to miss this. And so here is our chat with Christoph Beck after a quick word from these sponsors. All right, everyone, today is extra, extra special. Listeners of our podcast will know this to be true, but we have had some incredible guests on this show. Too many to count, and I am so grateful for all of them. This might be the most excited I've ever been to talk to somebody. And so let's get into it. Everyone, please welcome Christoph Beck to Friends from Work. Let's go, Christoph.
Christoph. I'm very flattered by that introduction. Thank you. It's great to be here.
We are so glad to have you. You've had a crazy year, Christoph. You've had Hawkeye currently. You had Free Guy, which was fantastic, your work there. And then, of course, WandaVision, which was a masterpiece. So you have not, I don't think you've probably had a ton of free time, it sounds like.
It's actually been a little bit less crazy than it would seem, because Free Guy, despite the fact that it came out this year, was completed over a year ago. And then release was delayed by the pandemic. So actually, I was all set to have a pretty busy year. And then a couple of movies that that were scheduled to be in post-production this year ended up getting delayed for one reason or another, mostly pandemic-related. So it's been actually a pretty sane year as far as my schedule.
Oh, good.
Very welcomingly so.
Good. Well, I we've got a lot to talk about sort of across the spectrum, and particularly with Hawkeye coming out now. But like we said, we're a huge fan of all of your work across the MCU. So we just wanted to take a second and kind of go all the way back to you coming on board with Ant-Man and hear from you what that process was like to kind of get started in the MCU and to sort of, in some ways, build a character from the ground up musically.
Thanks. I was brought onto Ant-Man by the director Peyton Reed, who I had worked with many years before, I think 15, 16 years prior to Ant-Man, on a movie called Bring It On. So we knew each other well from that experience, and he knew that I had experience on that film and many films since then with comedies, and Ant-Man was from the beginning meant to incorporate comedic elements into the MCU. I also know that Dave Jordan, who is the head of music at Marvel, was a big proponent of mine as well. So it was really an amazing opportunity for me. At the time, Marvel had already established itself as a force to be reckoned with, creatively and commercially, and obviously as a composer. Superhero films, broadly speaking, offer a pretty incredible palette to work with. The MCU has so many great characters. I never grew up reading Ant-Man comics. So at first I was like, oh, Ant-Man, okay, let's check this out, see what it's all about. Diving into that experience, both Peyton and I were excited to do something maybe a little bit against the mold. We went down, as often happens in filmmaking, you go down one path only to find out later, or at some point, that it's maybe not the right one. And I love telling this story. Peyton and I thought that it would be cool to score Ant-Man with a kind of real high concept, glitchy, electronic vibe. There is something about the way we think about insects that's skittery and how that could be expressed with electronic music and interesting and weird synth sounds. And then we played some of that music that we came up with initially to Kevin Feige, who's a bit more of a traditionalist. And he said, wow, this sounds amazing, but it makes me think like my speakers are broken. And I don't like to think my speakers are broken. So he nudged us to go toward a more traditional approach. And we realized we had maybe gotten a little bit caught up in our excitement and our shared love of this kind of music, took a step back and realized we were making a heist movie. And there's a long tradition of heist scores that date back to the 60s and 70s, particularly Lalo Schifrin and many others. And that was such a rich tradition of music to explore and was new to the MCU, at least. So it gave Peyton and I the feeling that we were exploring new territory, which is really what attracted us to this sort of weird high concept electronic direction in the first place. So I love what we ended up with. Those early electronic experiments are still sitting in my back pocket, waiting for the right moment and the right film to be to rehome. But in the meantime, I'm incredibly proud of the work we did on the Ant-Man score and its sequel as well, and really looking forward to the third one.
Oh man, yeah. I was listening to the Ant-Man and the Wasp score. You see the vinyl back behind me.
I do.
Today. That's one of my favorite scores in the entire Well, just in general. It's fantastic. I love the Ant-Man score, but what you incorporated with the Wasp, just that opening track you have is, it expands it all in a way that I wouldn't have ever foreseen listening to that Ant-Man score, but it makes it feel massive and emotional, but still kind of has that heist element. It's incredible.
Thank you so much.
That leads me perfectly into my next two things. One, I just want to say, you're kind of becoming the king of the heist, sneaking around sound. Because of not only Ant-Man the Wasp, but you get that in WandaVision some. Bongos. Yep. And I love that. So just compliment. Heist king right here.
And of course, your Hawkeye has a big...
sneaking around.
Sort of comedic, sneaky music as well. And I also should mention... Tower Heist, which is a movie starring Eddie Murphy and Ben Stiller from, I don't know, six, 7 years ago, which was my introduction to that genre. And a score that I'm incredibly proud of to this day.
That's so perfect. Second thing was, this is super deep cut and half our audience won't understand this, but you brought up the synths originally for Ant-Man. In Ant-Man and the Wasp, there's a track called Arthropody, which we never understand the title of.
Arthropod. So
okay, good. So we don't know how to say it.
And it's a play on a famous piece by a composer, Eric Satie, called Gymnopédie. So anyway, from a perspective of humor, another deep cut. But anyway, continue.
What are you using for your synth bass there? The synth bass that slowly filters in. What is that, please?
Yeah. I can't remember. I know this is a very unsatisfying answer to you. My guess is that it's a very, I know the piece well. I don't remember what I use for the synth, but I know one of my go-tos for just a big synth sound is also one of the go-tos for many of my colleagues. And I wouldn't surprise me to hear one of yours as well. A virtual instrument called Omnisphere, is a classic, cool for modern composers. And it just has very beautiful low end already in it. You don't have to do very much to it to get a nice beefy bass out of it. And
that top end grit.
That would be exactly, as you pointed out, the filter opening up gradually to let some of those high frequencies in. And if I'm not mistaken, and this is, again, we're going to lose maybe more than half your audience here, but like I believe that a sawtooth, just a pure analog sawtooth wave sample out of Omnisphere, that is one of my favorite sounds to use as a foundation for a bass sound, because you can open up the filter all the way and get all that buzz out of it. But if you close up the filter, it becomes very round and warm. And can really support what's going on in terms of low end in a piece. I'm really glad you noticed that. I'm gonna go looking on
that. Transitioning into WandaVision here, and I have to give you a tiny bit of background. You won't find larger WandaVision fans than the two people you're talking to right now.
Yeah.
So this is where I want to live. This was a masterpiece by you. When you got this project, obviously this is as unique as it comes, right? Like, was there a larger size or scope project you've ever gotten a call for? And let me just say this, for example, without even getting into the sitcom stuff, right? So just put that aside for a second. You already have to do like the suspense / horror moments with Beekeeper, Who Are You, tracks like that. Then you had to work in the love, like gentle moments with the Wanda and Vision theme. You also had the action moments, like the typical like Marvel action stuff with the Players, Sword, etc. And then you still have like the really sad reflective moments with What Is Grief, etc. All of which are so good. It's not like you half did any of it. It's all so good. And that's not even getting into the sitcom stuff. So was this a unique project to you in size and scope?
Oh, for sure. From the moment Marvel called me in to have a meeting about it and tell me about it, the details of the project were under wraps until I sat in that room with Matt Shackman, who directed all the episodes. I realized it was bonkers and incredibly ambitious. And you know, it's interesting. I think one of the reasons, and the answer is no, I've never quite had a project as wide ranging and as big as an ambitious as this one. One of the reasons is that it is a miniseries and not a feature film. There's only 2 hours, maybe a little bit more, of real estate in a feature film. And as a result, there's only so much you could be expected to do as a composer. But when you're talking about 6 hours, it's a whole different story. I would say the closest thing in my career that comes to the scope and ambition of WandaVision is Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which I scored 60 episodes of or so.
I didn't realize that.
Yes, and wow. That, similar to WandaVision, there was horror. There were horror elements. There were apocalyptic elements. There were romantic elements, doomed romance. There were more optimistic and beautiful moments as well. But the difference between WandaVision and Buffy is, I think, in the thematic approach. Mm-hmm. One of the things I loved about working on WandaVision is they had the 9 episodes written before they were shot. And so I had an idea of what was coming, and I was able to really plan out in a macro way what the important themes would be. And so there was a feeling when I was working on Buffy, because that's an ongoing series. They're cranking out an episode a week. They're doing 22 episodes per season. They're spending a week shooting each episode. It all moves so fast that there's barely time to take a breath. And there certainly isn't the opportunity to get a sense of how the season's going to play out and what themes are going to be there. So as a result, I believe WandaVision, as a result of both the incredibly epic runtime of the series taken as a whole and the opportunity to know ahead of time how it was all going to play out, it's one of the most strongly thematic score of any kind to date. And so I feel like similar to the way the show was incredibly ambitious and felt epic and covered so much ground, I feel the same way about my score, to a degree that I can't think of another project that comes quite close to that.
Well, now let's get to the sitcom stuff, Rob.
It's funny because we have this playlist that's called Journey Through the MCU, and it's just we try to pull a couple of tracks from each score, and that we think are kind of representative of the score.
Yeah,
as
good
a
luck.
Whole, right. So that was all well and good until we get to WandaVision, and you just blew up everything. And so people joke now, you know, you get through the Infinity Saga fairly quickly on that playlist, and then you get to WandaVision, and it's just insane. Because as I was going through that, I'm like, well, if I'm going to try to represent everything he's doing here, I mean, even like, for instance, in the Halloween episode, like you've got the Chili Con Carne little song, even if they're really short, you've got the moment whenever it does the flashback to Sokovia and the witch with the fish. And it's like, there's so much breadth there. And one is just so impressive, but it made me wonder how many hours of old sitcoms did you watch in preparation for this project?
That's basically the question. How did you pull this off? Because it sounds like so authentic to every decade. And I feel like it would have been an easy project to only do 80% of, you know, and like, kind of like, hey, it's a good knockoff. But this is like, I mean, unbelievable. We get to the 60s and 70s stuff with the bass that's picked, and like, are you kidding me? Let's go.
Well, first of all, thank you guys a lot for the kudos. It means a lot. Marvel's commitment to authenticity in this show was really present and evident from the beginning. In fact, I didn't find this out until after we had finished the show, but they tried to hire the actual like composers of those shows from the 50s and 60s and 70s.
Wow.
They went out to see if they could, like, for the sitcom stuff, get the actual guys who did it.
Wow.
It turned out to be difficult, especially for those early eras. Many of them have passed on. Certainly the ones that haven't are retired and maybe not up for jumping into a modern Hollywood post-production situation,
right,
especially Marvel's, which tend to be chaotic. Ultimately, and I'm obviously grateful for the opportunity, they decided to come to me. Knowing my background in comedy, knowing my reputation as a very versatile composer, and trusted me to apply that same commitment to authenticity that that was demonstrated by them actually going to these original composers. For me, I'm a child of the 80s and 90s, so and to a lesser extent the 70s. So, and I grew up watching those shows, so it was not a question of having to do research in terms of the later decades, but certainly for the earlier decades, there was, you know, I checked out an old episode of Dick Van Dyke Show, I Love Lucy, Bewitched, and immediately got the sense that it was a very jazzy feel. There was a, everything was very live, right? There was obviously no way to record, to have music in a TV show except to record live musicians. There was a small ensemble feel to it. And frankly, the feeling that I needed help. So I brought on a composer named Alex Kovacs, who spent a lot of time in his career working with what you might call a golden age veteran composers, and really understands that musical vernacular, understands all the jazz harmonies that go into it and the orchestrations. And, you know, I brought him on especially to work on the early decades, and he ended up staying on and helping out all the way through, especially with all the sitcom stuff. So I didn't do it all by myself, and it wasn't the result of a ton of research, more the result of lived experience of my own, which covers certain decades as we move through the decades, as we get through the series, and bringing on someone who also has a ton of experience working in those older styles of music from the earlier decades.
The cheesy 80s piano.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me, Christoph?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It's so good.
So what was the collaboration like between you and the folks that were writing the themes for each episode? Because obviously those blend really well together, and you get shout outs within your score to certain themes. So were y'all working hand in hand there?
More or less, more like hand then hand as opposed to hand in hand, because Bobby Kristen Lopez, who is the songwriters, who, by the way, I have a long history with. I went to Bobby and I were in the same a cappella college singing group. And
oh, wow.
Together, we run into each other at reunions and have since become friends, starting with working on Frozen. No, actually, right. He cold called me early in my career, right after he graduated, for advice on how to get his particular brand of musicals and songwriting going in Hollywood. I wasn't really able to help him at the time, but he obviously did just fine without me. he and Kristen I've been working with since Frozen 2. And we have a great friendship and a great working relationship. They know me as someone, and I like to think of myself as someone who really embraces the opportunity to, when working with original songs, to incorporate whatever musical material from those songs that makes sense into my score, especially in the case of a musical, and also in the case of something like WandaVision, where you have these really distinctive theme songs. I mean, the theme songs go right with the decades, and they're such a big part of every show.
And they're fantastic.
I'm sure they would thank you. I would pass that along. It only makes sense to try to incorporate the tunes from each of those songs into that respective show. But in addition to writing, you know, a whole bunch of great themes, they also did something very clever, which is they, within the world of the themes that they wrote, there is connective tissue. There's a four-note motif that they keep coming back to in really clever ways. You know, this was pointed out to me early on in the process. Matt was really excited to bring that into the score as well. So it's all over the score. In fact, it's the last thing you hear at the end of the end credits piece, a slight variation of it, but it's the same four notes. I think when you do stuff like that, it really helps to build a cohesive whole across the entire series, you know, from episode one to episode nine, that maybe not that many people notice overtly while they're watching the show, but on a subconscious level, it just brings it all together and it just connects every moment of every episode to every other moment.
Just because I can't keep here all night, I got to get out of WandaVision, but I wish I could talk to you for 8 hours about it. Like, one last compliment. Like, I can't even listen to that last track when Wanda's saying goodbye to Vision, and you work in the it kind of is building. It swells all the way into the love theme. Are you kidding me? I can't even listen to it anymore. Okay, but don't react to that because I got to go to the next one. But also, Wanda's theme, Ascendant, that track. Robbie and I did like a music themes power rankings. And it's funny because I think you held two of our three draft picks, with my number one being this Wanda's theme. Now, I have a couple questions about this. One, what is it like coming up with a theme for a character that A, is going to be around for a while, and B, doesn't really have a recognizable theme to this point? And are you thinking more about the project specifically regarding Wanda? Or are you thinking about the long term of like, hey, in the future, it'd be fun to bring this back up or whatever?
Well, as you know, there are a variety of composers who work on MCU movies. And I only get to compose the scores for the movies that I'm scoring, obviously. So I hope and trust that, for example, in Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, which I believe Danny Elfman is scoring. You know, hey, Danny, how you doing? Would be great to hear Wanda's theme in there if you can find a spot for it. And if not, that's okay too.
That's what we're here for.
That is basically the way I would answer that question is like, you know, we've got a great stable of composers with new people diving in all the time. And I believe in the talent. I believe in Marvel's ability to find the talent. And I believe in Kevin Feige's ability to direct the talent. I think that, you know, you heard, it was kind of a knock in the early years of the MCU that there were no recognizable themes and there wasn't enough continuity between the movies. And I understand why people would say that. Even if you agree or don't agree, I think you can say that that situation has gotten much better for a while. Alan Silvestri wrote just an amazing, now iconic theme for Avengers. You know, I used it several times in WandaVision, sometimes very subtly, and I'm sure, you know, we're going to hear that again.
But even as Captain America stuff now can be brought back in too.
Right, totally. There's such a wealth of great music in the MCU to continue to develop. And I know me personally, and I like to believe my colleagues feel the same way, that it's a great opportunity to, you know, just as me using that four note motif from the WandaVision songs creates a cohesion within the nine episodes of WandaVision, there's an opportunity here to create just a much more epic feeling of cohesion among what's 24, 25 movies now. And I hope that continues. As far as what it was like to create a theme for someone who didn't really have a big theme yet, the character of Wanda, well, that's just an amazing opportunity for a composer to establish that sound and to be, to get to be the composer that sets the tone. It is not the last time I'll get to do that. I can't wait till the next time. I will say one thing about that theme though, is particularly the end credits piece that really tickled me was even as much television scoring as I did early in my career, I never really had the opportunity to work on, to write a theme for a TV show. I did a couple of times, but they were shows that you know, didn't necessarily become iconic. And it was a great feeling watching the show, especially as it was airing, maybe with my kids, and getting to the end of a show and then hearing that theme come on mm-hmm. at the end of every episode. Mm-hmm. It gave me that feeling that I got like when I was a kid and yeah. your favorite thing came on and the theme came on from the other room. You're like, oh, I'm going to go watch the show. And I run to the TV and sit down. So that was a bit of a nostalgic tingle. Mm-hmm.
It became like inadvertently like a cultural thing because every episode would end on such a cliffhanger and go right That's into right. that theme. And then we'd all be like, oh, no, the yeah. theme. Yeah. That means it's over. Yeah.
I'm proud to be the author of music that could yes. be a trigger from now on.
And then, by the way, like you take the same theme, which is so mysterious, but then with Ascendant, you change that mm-hmm. one passing chord on the way down. Mm-hmm. And then it gets so triumphant.
Yeah,
and it's like the same melody, and I just love that stuff. Sorry, Robbie, I'll let you get a question in.
Well, I had a couple that spring up just from your last response there. One, you talk about, you know, these legends like Danny Elfman and Alan Silvestri, and how, you know, in the case of Elfman, you're sort of hoping that he'll carry forward. We're hoping they'll carry forward the Wanda theme. And with Silvestri, you know, you've used some of his stuff, but I also noticed, like in Endgame, Silvestri gives the Ant-Man theme a little shout out. And I was yeah. curious, you know, what's it like to hear a theme that you compose, you know, being arranged by, you know, kind of a legendary figure like Alan Silvestri in a film like Avengers Endgame?
Well, and that's a perfect transition into today's Hawkeye episode, because you worked in the, even for you, Alan Silvestri thing from Infinity War and Endgame and the Yelena thing. So shout out you for doing the same. Let's go. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I mean, I've been a huge fan of Alan's for a long time. My first encounter with him was I've done, I think, 7 or 8 films for a director named Sean Levy, who directed Free Guy. Sean has mm-hmm. also worked with Alan. And Sean asked me to write the music for his logo, his for his production company, mm. which is called 21 Laps. So before the movie starts, you'll see like 20th Century Fox logo, and then another logo, 21 Laps in this case, and you'll hear 10 seconds of something that I wrote for this logo. And there was orchestra in it, and Sean was like, hey, we're doing a session next week with Alan. Maybe you could just come by and piggyback, and we could just spend 10 minutes recording, you know, your 10-second wow. thing. And that was my first time meeting Alan, and we've since had the opportunity to run into each other several times, and we've become definitely much more friendly. But I remember being so intimidated by him in that first session and feeling so ashamed and guilty for taking 10 minutes of his session time to do my piddly little logo music. But no, as a huge fan of his, it's obviously an incredible honor and thrill to hear music that I wrote in another film, just as it is when I, you know, for example, was at Disneyland not too long ago and visited Avengers Campus, and they have music from the MCU on like a 40-minute loop piping through everywhere you walk in there. And the Ant-Man theme is one of them. It's really fun. You know, it makes me feel a little bit like a rock star, which is what I,
you should.
What I grew up dreaming to become. It's certainly not exactly the same type of rock star that I dreamed of becoming, but it's nice to feel that way once in a while.
Well, it's funny. Kyle actually did hint at something that I was going to ask about as well, but it was like, I noticed to kind of transition into Hawkeye, you know, there was a very obvious placement of this track from Infinity War and Endgame that Silvestri used. Particularly in this moment, it's a callback to when Black Widow dies.
Yep.
And I was just curious kind of what that, we've talked a bit about this, talking about WandaVision, but what that looks like as you're scoring an episode and you come up on a moment like that in the script. How do you get right. to the process of just, you know, deciding to pull something like that in?
That was a little bit tricky, actually, because, you know, we sat down to watch the episode together, me and the producers. Mm-hmm. And we came to that moment when he's telling that story in his apartment or in Kate's apartment. someone's apartment. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a request of the producers, you know, can we call back that moment? And I said, sure, let me go revisit it, check it out. And it's really big. Mm-hmm. And it's not particularly long either. So it's kind of, it's definitely, you definitely could not take that piece of music and put it in this scene. It would just feel totally outsized for the intimate moment that Kate Bishop and Hawkeye are sharing in that, mm-hmm. In that scene. So the challenge was, how can we take this kind of epic tragedy feeling and scale it down, way down, so it becomes, so it still have that feeling of grief and regret, but it's not overtaking the scene sonically or emotionally. So that was just a question of really simplifying it and paring it down. So it's a really different arrangement than what was in Endgame. Yeah.
Hmm.
Well, we're loving it. I want to let you go on this. Hawkeye, loving it so far, loving the theme. Now, we don't have access to the score yet on Spotify, so it's just based off the show. Is there anything in particular you want us and our listeners to be looking for? Something you're really proud of this Hawkeye score?
Well, first of all, one thing you and your listeners should be looking for is the soundtrack dropping, which is going to be this Friday.
Good.
Is the best news I've heard all week.
Yep.
The first track on that soundtrack is the theme in all its glory.
Yeah.
In super high quality. So there's that. But I would say there are, just as there were in WandaVision, there are a lot of musical Easter eggs in the score, particularly that moment from Avengers, Infinity War. And that's not the last you're going to hear of it in this show. It will come back. And also Yelena's theme as well. That will be coming back. Just as in WandaVision, it was an opportunity for me to create a very strongly thematic score. Like just about every piece of music has some reference to one of the main themes of the score. So those listeners of yours who have eagle ears, there's a lot there to chew on.
And Christmas elements.
Yes.
And the Christmas elements. Maybe I'm the heist guy. You could also argue that I'm the Christmas guy. I have quite a few of Christmas movies on my credit list. I will say, though, I've resisted so far the temptation to use actual sleigh bells in all of my Christmas projects until this one.
Right. And I was about to say.
Yeah. Yeah. So this will forever be known, at least to myself, as a project where I finally caved.
Well, I know our listeners are going to be so excited to hear that soundtrack is dropping. We are so glad that we got the chance to talk to you. We're so grateful to you for coming on. Can't wait to see how this Hawkeye score finishes out. And you referenced this earlier. I'm really, really excited to see what we get in the Ant-Man 3 score. So I'm going to sort of be eagerly awaiting that. And maybe we can have you back on whenever that's a little bit closer. To talk about that process as well.
Anytime, guys. So much fun to be here.
Thanks, Christoph.
Thank you, guys.
If you couldn't tell, Robbie, I mean, at one point I was full-blown fanboying there. I mean, I kind of said to you, like, it's less that I have questions for Christoph and more that I just want to shower him with praise, right? And then let him react.
I mean, you were right in that conversation could have, he was very gracious with his time. And I think we could have easily kept him for another couple of hours without running out of things to say.
Right. But I thought it was fun what he said for our listeners out there, be listening for more themes that he brings in, which we've conditioned our listeners to be listening for that. So when he said, I hope you have eagle ears out there, I'm like, yeah, I think we do. I think we do.
We do. And he noted that this Hawkeye score is going to finally drop on streaming services on Friday. So if you were listening to this on Thursday when it releases. One more day, baby.
Let's go. Okay, holy cow, this has been so much fun. Thank you to everyone who bought merchandise this week. Thank you to everyone who sent in voicemails. We have so much more to go. How have you guys been feeling about Hawkeye? How are you feeling about Spider-Man? Let us know, theffwpodcast.com or on our Slack. There's a link to our Slack on that website or on social media at theffwpodcast. And as always, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We love you all so much. We'll see you on Monday for a special Spider-Man episode on Friends from Work.